This week's episode of the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by the Autoblog Daily Digest. It's a great way to stay updated with what's happening in the world of cars in just 2 or 3 minutes every day. Ask your smart speaker for the Autoblog Daily Digest to stay up to speed with the latest car news, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today is Road Test Editor Zach Palmer. How you doing, man?
Not too bad. How's it going with you?
It's good. Last week was the Autoblog Green Podcast. Today, we're basically not talking at all about electric cars. We're going to burn fossil fuels and talk about V8 engines. That's just kind of the way it works out. We were kind of joking about this beforehand, before the show started. Hey, it's like the anti-Autoblog Green Podcast. That's not what this is, but there's a lot to talk about in the high-performance V8 engine sector this week, and it's kind of fun. We're going to be all electric probably soon, and that's cool too, but let's have fun with these 8-cylinder monsters while they exist. Then we'll talk about what we've been driving. I'm super excited. Zach drove the TLX. I can finally talk to somebody about this car that I had for like 6 weeks. Zach and I actually were able to do kind of a trade here, and that worked out well. Talk about the Cadillac Escalade, which Zach has been driving, and the BMW M550i, which is a very cool car. I've spent some time in the 5 Series recently, so we've got a lot to talk about there, actually. Finally, we will spend your money. If you have spent my monies, I'll tell you this right now, please send them to podcast@autoblog.com. We want more of them. Send more of them, but we've got a good one for you today. So let's jump right in. This week apparently was V8 week. Take a drink of V8. I used to actually kind of like V8, like tomato juice, maybe a little bit of vodka, kind of like a, you know, Bloody Mary sort of drink. It's pretty healthy, vitamins, minerals, all that good stuff. But I mean, let's just jump right in. Pricing on the 392 Jeep Wrangler, $75,000. My first thought is my eyes are like kind of popping out. We knew it would be this expensive. I mean, to me, this is a little off-putting, to be perfectly honest. I don't need this kind of performance in a Jeep. It's not what I would use a Wrangler for. So I'm perfectly happy with the EcoDiesel, the Pentastar V6, the Turbo 4, or I believe the plug-in hybrid. So like, I don't know. This to me is not how I would spend my money, if you will. What do you think?
Yeah, man, this is fun. You know, going from full green to pushrod V8s this week. This 392 price, like you said, it sounds nuts, just totally out there on the surface. $75,000 for a Wrangler. It is the launch edition. I should point that out. So it comes like equipped with literally everything that you could possibly spec in a Jeep. Which, if you've built a Jeep as of late, you'll notice you can get them into the $60,000 range these days. If you go with an EcoDiesel, Rubicon, every last thing. I'm not sure if Jeep is going to offer this in any sort of a cheaper trim. That definitely seems like the way to go. But $75,000 out the door in something that, man, it's something that you really don't need. Like 4.5 seconds to 60 in a Wrangler. Just, you know, the Wrangler isn't designed for something like that. It sounds slightly terrifying, a whole lot of fun. The Fox off-road shocks probably going to be fantastic if you actually get out there on the dunes and use this thing for what it's for. But right now, it just sort of feels like a play toy for somebody who has a whole lot of money and a garage spot open.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I will say this. I mean, the way you describe it, it does sound terrifying. Because, I mean, sometimes when you drive a Wrangler with that, like, kind of, like, way, like, far out steering, you're pretty high up. Yeah, it can feel a little, it's very different, let me put it that way, than driving a traditional automobile. Let me put it that way. But all that power, all that speed, that's a lot, man. I don't know how I feel about that. But I mean, it's a great engine. This is an amazing engine. FCA, or I guess Stellantis, Jeep, It's a tried and true V8, so no issues there. And I think you actually frame it up pretty well there, Zach. Would you say that this is like the anchor and the heart of this package they're offering? And you get a lot of other things. Like when you frame it like that, and this is a very top-end Wrangler with a very powerful engine, that's really the way to put it. I hope you'll be able to get this cheaper, which would make a lot more sense. Because, I mean, this V8, it's only 470 horsepower. I mean, you know, that's... it's available at a much lower cost than other, you know, vehicles Stellantis makes. Let's put it that way. So, yeah. You know, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, this, it sort of feels like Jeep has just, like, had this in their back pocket for years. It's kind of like waiting for the Bronco to come out. Yeah. And then as soon as the Bronco comes out, they're like, hey, guys, look, we finally put a V8 in the Jeep. Yeah. Oh, and it also is going to cost $75,000. By the way, you know, it's a fun vehicle. There's no doubt about that. But like you were saying off the top, you know, I would much rather have a 4xe or even just the standard 2-liter turbo. Those are my probably two favorite specs of the Wrangler. A 392, you know, I'd much rather have that engine in, say, a Charger Scat Pack.
Yes.
Or a Challenger. Yes. Scat Pack than pony up this huge, huge dollar amount for a crazy Jeep.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, I mean, the people who want this, I don't think they'll have any problems selling these.
Nope.
I think there's certainly going to be a market for them. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, obviously, whenever there is, like, a new Jeep, people scoop them up. But, yeah, I mean, to your point, a Scat Pack, those start, like, in the 40,000-ish range, give or take, more like, give. But I mean, it's just like, wait a minute, this seems like a lot of money for this engine, you know. I mean, naturally, it's the V8 they would have to put in a Wrangler. Like, putting a Hellcat engine would make no sense. I mean, that would be absolutely terrifying, driving a Jeep Wrangler with a Hellcat engine. I think that would just be like, no thank you. So as much as I've been a little skeptical, I mean, it's going to be awesome. You know, and if you want a V8 and a Wrangler, this is your chance.
Yeah, so. I know. It's finally here. I know that they've, you know, people have been asking for it. I know that Hennessy and other, I think that AEV has done V8 conversions in Wranglers before. And, you know, those are always slightly interesting, sort of seem like some weird aftermarket builds. As you actually mentioned Hellcat there, I've seen Hellcat swapped Wranglers and Gladiators rolling out there. They exist. There's definitely not many people that do it because, like you say, like, why? For the most part. But, hey, now you can get it from the factory, which, hey, it's interesting to say the least.
Yeah, no. So somewhat coincidentally, like, I think it was about the same time frame, the Defender, Land Rover, announced that it will be getting a V8 option. We'd already known that there were some other engines offered throughout the lineup, six of the four. But this is the, this is the 518 horsepower, if I'm reading this right. Yep, supercharged. So, hey, that sounds good. It's the 2022 model year. This makes a lot of sense to me. Like, I drove the Defender last fall, and... yeah, I mean, it's plenty capable with the V6. That's fine. But, I mean, it's a luxury SUV. It's certainly a large enough vehicle to accommodate something, you know, a headier engine, if you will. So, yeah, you know, I think this is actually a good move. And plus, I will say this. Again, as much as I was ragging on Jeep for that high price tag, Jeep is a luxury good in some ways. Land Rover is definitely a luxury good in some ways. It's just also sometimes somewhat surprisingly affordable. We don't know pricing on this, but let's see, a V8, I mean, if the V8 Wrangler is $75,000, I think the V8 Defender is probably not going to be super cheap either. But yeah, it sounds good.
Yeah, no, I mean, I imagine this one will be easily pushing six figures as soon as you start throwing a few options into it. That's interesting that you say this. I mean, you drove the inline six version last year, and now, and so you sort of think that there is room on top of it for a V8. Just like looking at it from the outset, I really don't see a huge need for an inline six in this vehicle. For a V8 in this vehicle. The Range Rover seems like a more, you know, very suitable place for a V8, but the Defender has always, you know, felt like this, you know, very focused off-roady type of, you know, rock crawler type of SUV, and it's just like, well, like, the V8, you know, do you really need to hit 60 in under 5 seconds in a Defender? Like, I don't know, I would just much rather have that in a Range Rover and, you know, just rock out with the four-cylinder or i6 in a Defender. One thing that the guy that wrote this up for us, Byron Hurd, he pointed out that it's 600 to 700 pounds heavier than one with the inline six, which is, it's a pretty big penalty for going V8. You know, all that extra power that you get is definitely, you know, not super helpful in the whole power to weight ratio talking right there as well. So, you know, pluses and minuses, you get the V8 badge, you know, you probably get a pretty great V8 sound. But I still think that it's the inline six for me is the way to go for the Defender.
Inline six, I think I said V6, but yeah, absolutely. To be clear, I really enjoyed the inline six. It's a great engine, and it fits, I think, the Defender very appropriately. But looking at, you know, they use this engine in the Range Rover Sport, and I believe a few other engines, but just this was literally the first one that I saw come up. So, I mean, I sort of feel like if you're Land Rover, and strong engines, often V8s, are what you do, you want to proliferate that across your lineup. I think it was James Ryswick made this point too in probably his buying guide for the Defender. Land Rover sort of reimagined the Defender. It's not just like this British thing that you strap on like your barber coat and, you know, put the retriever in the back. I mean, it certainly can be. I mean, my retriever was riding in it. But for a lot of Americans, it's not, you know, it's like, the Defender name doesn't have that cachet, if you will, like Bronco and Wrangler do. I mean, I think enthusiasts absolutely know what it is, but it's not this like name that's just so ubiquitous. I bet you most people could probably see a picture of one and be like, what's that? You know, oh, a Land Rover. Okay, I get it. Yeah. But I feel like what they're trying to do is make a modern Defender, one that appeals to a variety of buyers, perhaps new ones, you know, not just the ones who want the old rugged 4x4. They want, you know, they're cross shopping it with a Mercedes G-Class, you know, that sort of customer. So I think it's smart to try to evolve the business case here and make it broader, even if, I mean, it's definitely an unconventional move. But speaking of somewhat unconventional moves, I don't even know if I'd call this unconventional, but IS500 is here with a V8. This is the F Sport. I'm reading the headline here. It's kind of awesome. I mean, this is not a particularly large car that's getting the whopping 5-liter V8. It's 472 horsepower. This is, I think, an amazing engine. This is like literally the engine in some ways turned me on to Lexus as a brand, because it's like, oh, hey, wow, these guys are not messing around. Like, look what they could do. This is like, I mean, there were some Lexus sedans that were like as exciting to drive as any BMW or Cadillac V-Series, you know, from a few years ago. They were that good. I think they're still okay. They're still fine. But this is a nice move, I think, for the IS line. You know, I mean, again, it's a luxury brand. Sure. Hot rod it up, all good.
This reveal was, you know, I was more excited about this reveal than, I don't know, a whole lot for a long while. To actually see somebody put a V8 back into a compact luxury sedan, you know, that's crazy cool. And it happens at the same time that Mercedes just announced that the V8 is going away from the C-Class AMGs. Obviously, you get an M3, M4 that has an inline six, Audi RS5, that's a twin-turbo V6. Everybody is going smaller downsized with turbocharging, and Lexus is like, hey, look at our 5-liter V8, it's awesome. And that's essentially what they've done here is, you know, taken their awesome 5-liter V8 that's in cars like the LC500, the GSF, the RCF, you know, all Lexus performance products that we really like, and they stuffed it in the new IS, which is a sedan that I haven't driven yet, but, you know, from our first drive that Byron also wrote, you know, they made a whole lot of improvements to this car, specifically handling. So I have high hopes here. You know, so it's sort of weird in that this isn't, you know, a full ISF. This is an IS500F Sport Performance, which is more than an F Sport, but it's less than a full ISF. So it's sort of sitting in this new middle ground of Lexus performance that they say we're going to get more of, you know, over the next few years. Obviously, the engine is the big thing here, but, you know, it gets the F-Sport suspension, F-Sport brakes, F-Sport interior stuff. It gets a limited slip rear diff, and it's rear-wheel drive only. So you don't get the things you don't get are the like the full F appearance stuff on the outside. You don't get any crazy wings or splitters or big F badges on there. So it's sort of more of like a sleeper-ish look. You just get an IS500 badge back there, and you know, so you have all these awesome performance things. It doesn't necessarily look, you know, as shouty and loud as say an M3 or a C63 AMG, but I will wager that this thing might be as fun to drive as those cars, if not even more fun with the naturally aspirated V8 that revs to right about 7,500 RPM in every single other car, and my lord, it sounds glorious.
I mean, literally everything you just said is why I like this car, is because it's a little bit of a sleeper car. You don't get some of that extra showy stuff that, you know, I mean, honestly, some of that I think Lexus takes a little bit too far. Like Lexus and Cadillac, it's almost like, well, previously Cadillac with some of the old V cars, it seemed like they were trying a little too hard to just show how severe these cars could be. Some would argue maybe Audi is starting to drink some of that Kool-Aid while Cadillac is starting to dial things down. Because I think the CT4 looks great right now. It's very almost like 1960s simplistic. Anyways, yeah, 5-liter V8 in this thing, that's awesome. I mean, and it's like, you know, I'm looking at like the cars that you could get it in. You know, you're talking the RCF or the LC and the LC convertible. For some reason, I thought it was available in something else, but I'm not seeing that.
There's the GSF, but that car is being killed off. So
yes, no yeah, that's longer. What I thought.
Yep.
So I mean, to me, it's a good move. I mean, this is a differentiator. This is how you like, you win enthusiasts to your brand, because you could get a V8 in this segment and the car looks like this, and it, you know, by making it a F Sport Performance as you laid out, you can probably charge a little bit less for it, almost take like the Dodge method of, you know, scat packing cars and, you know, charging sort of a little bit less than you would if it was a full execution, and more just like saying, here's the car, here's the motor, here you go. So, yeah, I mean, my only confusion is why even bother with the performance here? Like, to me, like, this is an F Sport, like, or an F, if you will. I'm already confusing their lineups here, but like, it's got the engine, you know? Like, I mean, I don't care about all that other stuff. I don't know, it feels like a winner to me.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I would have loved for it to be like a full ISF. Like you said, you know, to harken back to the original ISF from, man, over 10 years ago now. But, you know, by doing this like halfway there thing, you know, they can get away without making it, you know, as stiff or racetrack focused, or, you know, quite as fast. I mean, it's 0-60 in 4.5 seconds, which, you know, that's plenty fast, but it's not as quick as, say, an M3 or, you know, a C63S AMG. Those cars are sub-4 now. And, you know, this car just isn't quite as quick, but because it's not a full-on F, it's also going to be cheaper than those things. And honestly, if you can get this thing for maybe around the same price as, say, like a BMW M340i or an Audi S4 or, you know, the light AMG, the AMG 43, this is like a crazy good buy. You know, you're getting a Lexus with a fantastic 8-speed transmission, rear-wheel drive only, which is also semi-rare these days. You know, you're getting a lot of all-wheel drive cars in that sort of M Sport to light AMG range. So this car has a lot of things going for it that I think really appeal to enthusiasts, and well, it really appeals to me as well. I am super psyched to drive this thing.
Cool. Let's talk about, let's just transition right into the M550, because I feel like we're talking sedans that are powerful. That's kind of it's obviously a larger car, but this was the rear wheel drive car, if I'm looking at the run sheet right.
No, it's actually all-wheel drive.
Was it all-wheel drive? Okay.
Yeah, the M550 is. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, what'd you do with it?
Yeah, so hot take, I think that the M550 is the M-ified BMW 5 Series to buy. Okay. I would buy it before the M5 or the M5 competition. I think it's just the perfect balance of performance and comfort and daily drivability out of all of them. So you get the 4-liter twin turbo V8, 523 horsepower, 553 pound feet of torque, 0-60 in 3.6, so it's stupid fast. Obviously the M5 does it in about 3 seconds. You don't necessarily need that. But the 5 Series is so big these days that an M5 is, it's not, you know, the agile, you know, little 5 Series performance sedan that, you may remember of 20 plus years ago. So since it's so big, you know, I like that the M550, you know, sort of plays to the comfort-oriented, you know, daily driving situations that you might find yourself in. But at the same time, it has the rip-roaring power, and it also handles really, really well. You get the M Sport adaptive suspension on it. Thing stiffens up really nicely. You know, really controls the body well. As you're throwing it down a back road, and then when you put it on the highway, it just serenely floats along in comfort mode and super quiet. And just off you go. It's a really great duality of a sports sedan, I think. And I personally think that it's the 5 Series of choice if you're going to pony up for an M something. I will note that my test car was $93,000, so that is no small chunk of change to pay for a luxury sedan. But everything you get, you know, you get fully loaded, awesome leather interior. BMW tech is iDrive is pretty darn good these days. And a huge back seat. It's overall a very, very lovely car. If you need something to commute back and forth to work with, but also bomb down some back roads if you need to. And unlike the M5, it won't beat you up, and it's slightly more usable because you're not hitting extra legal speeds quite as quick. That's not to say it isn't fast, but it's not supercar fast like the M5 is, which is almost a bit much, honestly, for roads that with how big and unwieldy the thing is these days. So
cool. I like your approach there. It's the M5 to buy, or the powerful 5 Series to buy. Because you get the motor, which to me is, I think that's a brilliant engine that BMW offers. I think it's actually really good in the 5 Series because it's just enough car. It's just enough motor for just enough car. And I really think the 5 Series fits in well, obviously, between the 3 and the 7. And it's just that the 5 Series, I feel like, has a good sense of identity. It's a good combination of, like, yeah, it's a little bit bigger than the 3 Series, which is larger than it used to be, but it's still, you know, maybe not a car that is going to fit for, even if you have, like, a dog or kids or whatever, it's still a little on the smaller side for practical pursuits. The 5 Series, you could get a lot of things done with it. The 7 Series, I was lucky enough to drive that once at Monticello. Most people will never put a 7 Series on a track. In fact, many people will probably put use the 7 Series as almost like, you know, it's like a limousine or an executive car. But, you know, to me, just the 5 Series really is like, hits that, you know, that right balance of it's a fast, large car. And this to me feels like the right trim too. You know, I drove the 5 Series a while back. It ironically was the same one consumer editor Jeremy Korsnewski was driving. Funny little thing happened on the way to the opera or whatever that old movie was. You know, by coincidence, I ended up getting in the same car. I think I was supposed to get the hybrid. Yeah. That's okay. So I don't know. I like the 5 Series. A lot of times when people say, everybody always says, well, BMW versus Mercedes, when they're like usually to benchmark, they'll throw an Audi in there. And I'll usually give the disclaimer, well, the interior and the C and the E classes are generally better. You know, their sound systems are a little bit better. Their infotainment systems are beautiful, a little bit better. I think design is a little bit of a toss up. If you want more like over the top stuff, go Mercedes. You know, BMW, I think, captures, even in a more complicated form, that austere German sporty athletic look, if you will. But I always find an emotional, like, I don't know, requiem for the 5 Series. I don't know what it is. It's a car that just has always kind of stayed with me as a, I don't know. I just really like the 5 Series in some ways because I like the balance of what it can do. So it's interesting to hear because this is the trim I would probably look to get, if you will.
Yeah, no. I honestly think that, you know, the mid-level M Sport trim in a lot of BMWs are the ones to buy these days. I have similar thoughts, like when it comes to the X5 M50i versus an X5 M. Just, you know, the M, it beats you up. You know, it's a very stiff riding car. It's a very, very serious car. And the X5 M50i, on the other hand, you still get the 4.4 liter twin turbo V8. You still have over 500 horsepower, same torque. You know, you're not losing a whole lot except for the, you know, trackability, like you mentioned, tracking a 7 Series on Monticello, which is hilarious. But, you know,
it's pretty good too. Not gonna lie, it was handled pretty well.
Yeah. As most BMWs tend to do, they always have some pretty good suspension wizardry going on there. But yeah, no. I mean, if you're thinking about a performance 5 Series, I definitely think M550i the whole way. Save yourself the extra $15,000-$20,000 over an M5 or an M5 competition, and you're gonna have just as much fun and be that much happier when you're not at the drag strip or the racetrack.
So tell me about this Cadillac Escalade you were rolling around in.
Yeah, back to pushrods, I suppose.
Yeah.
This one had the 6.2 liter V8. It was a Sport Platinum. It was pretty much as decked out as you could get, except for one very pivotal option, which is Super Cruise. Did not have Super Cruise, which I was semi-disappointed in. You save about $2,500. I don't think it's worth it to save that. Super Cruise is an incredible technology at how good it is. But the Escalade, what an improvement over the previous GM full-size SUVs. I haven't driven any of them yet. I hadn't driven the Tahoe, the Yukon, any other Escalades at all. This is my first experience in it. And the thing that really, you know, stands out the most is the ride. So this had the MagRide dampers. It had the air suspension. And of course, like every other GM full-size SUV, it has the independent rear suspension. This thing rides like a dream. Like, I was shocked the entire week at how much better this thing rode than the previous Cadillac Escalade. I drove one of the Escalades of the previous generation right at the end. So I've driven it semi-recently. You know, that thing versus, say, a Navigator or any other independent suspension full-sizer, it beat you up a little. You know, it wasn't exactly a rough ride, but it was not as sophisticated or anywhere near as comfortable as it is now. And you know, that's what you get for moving from the, you know, the solid rear truck axle to the independent. And you know, it's a huge improvement. I really cannot stress how much better it is and how much it's worth actually going for this car over, you know, one with the solid rear. Now, the other super impressive part about it was the interior. I'm sure if you've done any research into the new Escalade, you've seen the giant wall of OLED screens in front of you. Total of 38 inches right there. And it is quite the sight to take in when you hop in. You know, they're sort of one on top of each other. It's with a nice stacking look to it. It looks really, really luxurious. You know, it looks expensive. It looks nice. There's great stitching and leather on the outside of it. And really, it just, you know, appears really, really well, which is what you want to see, because, you know, GM has been knocked on plenty of Cadillacs previous to this for, you know, borrowing Chevy parts or just all around just dipping into the general GM parts bin. Now, there's a tiny bit of that going on with some buttons here and there, but honestly, this Escalade is feels like a Cadillac through and through on the inside. Mine actually had this very purpley like leather. It's technically called auburn, but for all intents and purposes, it looks like purple, which I think is awesome that you can get an actual like purple-like interior on an Escalade. You know, that's something that Cadillac needs to do to compete with Lincoln's Black Label. You know, you can get a really awesome like sea blue or like a mahogany red in a Navigator, which is something that Cadillac just flat out didn't offer before. You know, you could not get interesting colors, and now you can, which is good. So you know, overall, this thing is a huge improvement over the previous Escalade, I think. And the $112,000 started, or the $112,000 ending price that mine won is certainly a big pill to swallow. But when you're driving it, when you're in there with all the tech, you know, it really starts to feel as though, you know, it is $112,000 worth of car. Which is an impressive feat, you know, for Cadillac, which has been, you know, roundly criticized over the past many years for feeling like they cheaped out on the interior or just all around not living up to expectations. I think that this one does live up to the expectations that it should. So,
I drove the Suburban last fall. Actually, it was only December, so it's not that long ago even. But the independent rear suspension that are on these new large GM SUVs really does make a difference. It lets them open up more storage space in the back, which it takes a little bit of like explaining on how that all balances out, but the packaging is better back there. You could put more things in the back of these things, which is important. I could noticeably tell the difference between the Suburban versus, I realized that the last one I had been in was a Tahoe, which I know is a smaller vehicle, but the framing is very, very similar, and it was noticeable in this new Suburban how much more stuff you can get back there. It's just much more open and logical, and the ride and handling did improve. And then when you talk about translating that to like Cadillac, I think that's, you know, this segment is very competitive right now with like what Lincoln is doing, and then some of the other just large crossovers and SUVs that we're now seeing get into the market. Cadillac had to really kind of upgrade the interior, get the suspension and just like the suspension improved and make it just more like a little bit more competitive. You know, the Navigator is really good right now. So it was time to, I think, bring its A game. I would have liked for you to have tested the Super Cruise. Because I would have been curious how that is in such a large SUV, but, you know, another time, I guess.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this thing was loaded to the gills with every single other piece of tech. It had, you know, one small neat thing it had was this new AR navigation camera, which literally puts, there's a camera on the front of the car, which sends a live feed, an HD feed to the instrument cluster.
Oh, cool.
Which is just super wild to take in and really trippy, honestly, at the start. But there's no lag to it, and you can drive along at 70 miles per hour. And there's a 12-inch HD, it's a 14-inch display. There's a 14-inch HD display of what's happening in front of you right there. And then they'll overlay animated arrows, or they'll throw a pin on your destination as you're nearing it there. It really felt like a neat evolution to a navigation system that, well, you don't really see in most cars' navigation systems. The new S-Class has a similar AR trick, but we haven't driven that car yet. This is the first one that I've seen that has done that. And, you know, in addition to actually having that, the camera itself helps somewhat, because the thing is just so freaking huge. You know, it's really tough to actually see where the front of it is.
Yeah.
It's so far out there, and you're so high up. And it's just so large on the road, that, you know, the huge battery of cameras that this thing has, really, really help, you know, make it feel more manageable.
Okay, so let's talk about the Acura TLX. This joined our long-term fleet last month, early in January. It was delivered a little bit surprisingly to my house. We weren't quite expecting it to, the whole just long-term arrangement to come together so quickly. Was awesome. Glad it's here. We've already had it for a month, so that's great. I wrote the intro, so check that out if you're curious what we have. But we've mentioned that on a couple of podcasts, and I feel like I'm talking to myself. Finally, somebody else at Autoblog has driven the car, which is great. You actually, I think, did a TLX first drive, if I recall, last fall. Is that right? Or am I imagining that?
I did, yes. Okay. It was a short program where I drove both the A-spec, the trim that we have, and an advanced spec model. So I've driven both different versions of it there.
Right. Well, what are your impressions of this car?
So the thing that really stands out to me the most about the TLX is the chassis. This thing is riding on a totally new platform designed from the ground up to be, you know, performance. It's meant for an enthusiast to like. It's meant for good handling. And I took it out for a cruise last night just for the hell of it, because I was really, really wanting to drive it. And just as I was thinking in my first drive, chassis still holds up. This thing is quite impressive. It sort of reminds me in a way about some of the newer Cadillacs, in that, you know, like the CTS and ATS, and now the CT4 and CT5. Those things just have brilliant chassis underneath them, and you don't necessarily expect it from the way they look or from their engines or transmissions or anything about it, but they're really, really good underneath, and the TLX is the same way. It was kind of funny as I was setting out yesterday on my drive. You know, I pulled out onto the main road and got up to 60 miles an hour, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, some turkey comes flying down, lands on the road directly in front of me. I have to slam on the brakes, juke out of the way, and you know, this. In that moment right there is like, wow, this thing is like crazy agile. Like, it just changed directions so quick, and I could not be happier that I was not driving that Escalade and that I was driving the TLX in that moment.
Thanksgiving dinner is what you would have been having, and
literally this was not a smart turkey. The dude was just flying through the sky and is like, I'm gonna land right in front of you right now as you're driving 60 miles an hour. So that was fun. But no, then I got out to some good roads, and that's where this thing really, really comes alive underneath you. I am Still not. I haven't made my mind up totally on how I feel about the powertrain and how that's playing. I've said probably a few times on previous podcasts, I'm an owner of a 2001 Acura Integra GSR. It has this lovely high-revving, naturally aspirated four-cylinder, and the throttle feels like it's on a wire. The response is just, it's so perfect and so lovely. And you lose a lot of that, you know, direct and immediate throttle response when you go turbocharging. And, you know, I can sense that, you know, in this TLX, you know, there's a whole lot of power, there's a whole lot of torque, but it's not that immediate, you know, driver connection feel that I'm used to with my Acura. And that is just the way of cars these days, unfortunately. You know, you give up some of that immediate feeling from acceleration for, you know, overall torque and the efficiency of a turbocharged engine. I'm also still a little hesitant on the transmission itself. I thought that it wasn't quite up to snuff on my first drive. You know, it didn't shift fast enough in manual mode. It wasn't smart enough downshifting and holding gears when it should have. I think the jury is still out on that one. You know, it will play well when you're actually getting after it on a back road, but it's just, you know, it's not as quick or as fast responding as, say, like a ZF8 speed in a 3 Series, or same thing in an Audi A4. And that's just, you know, a small step behind that is unfortunate, you know, when you don't have the option of a manual transmission, as this car doesn't have the option of a manual. You just got to deal with whatever the best transmission tuning that they have. And, you know, whereas the chassis is this beautiful, like, enthusiast focused thing that makes me super happy, and the car handles really, really well. Some of the supporting things, you know, I'm still not 100% sure on. Ask me again at the end of the month, I think, after I've spent some more time in this thing, because I still haven't, honestly, I haven't completely made my mind up on it yet with just driving it like two times now. So yeah, all right. Those are some quick TLX thoughts for you.
Yeah, for me, I feel like, and I wrote this in my kind of overview, you really want to, like in sort of the intro piece, you want to tease it out and try and like lay out a mission for the car. At least that's what my goal in writing this piece was. And for me, Acura has a lot riding on this car. This is, you know, their definitive attempt to make a sports sedan that people will get excited about. A lot of the ingredients are there. Some of them aren't, that you, I think, lay out pretty well, that there's some things about the powertrain that maybe aren't all that special. There's going to be like more to come with the TLX, more powerful, likely version this spring. So, I mean, they're certainly leaving some, you know, some things out there that, you know, we will probably test later. I think from a design standpoint, they just crushed it. You know, the cliche that it looks rear-wheel drive. Well, I mean, what does that even mean? But yeah, I mean, it looks like a performance sedan. So I think in that sense, it's good. The A-spec trim, it's a good look for this car.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
The blue paint and A-spec trim, yes, 100% there for it.
I think I already feel more fired up about this car than I do the Volvo S60 we had. No diss against the S60, which was, it was a plug-in hybrid. It was a very elegant car. But this TLX is a little more visceral, if you will. And I'm only comparing long-termer to long-termer just because we literally swapped the cars, I think the same week even. So, you know, I think we're going to have some fun with this one. You put the winter tires on it. It hasn't snowed yet, which is, of course, how it's going to happen. You put the winter tires on it and it hits 50 the next day, but, you know, that'll be fun.
I'm sure that Michigan will gift us with a large March or April snowstorm, as it tends to do, where we can, like you said, we can test out those winters. We have some Nokian Haka Palitas on there right now, so good. Bring on the snow, please, Mother Absolutely. Nature.
Yeah. Any other thoughts about it? You know, I know you didn't get a ton of time in it. We'll talk about this more as the time goes on.
Yeah. But I mean, like you said, the looks are really good, and the interior, I'm similarly impressed by the looks and the actual driving position itself. You know, like, this is a sports car like driving position. It's very enthusiast oriented, in that you sit in there low. You know, there's a really you know, expansive and sports car like cockpit that you have there. The dashes glow red back at you. You know, you have a lot of easy to reach dials that you know, they're not distracting or difficult to use or anything. So it feels very, you know, user centric and you know, ergonomically correct, which is a Honda and Acura trait. They tend to do that very well, and I think that the TLX's cockpit really does that well as well. You know, there's no gimmicks. It's not, you know, like it's going to confuse somebody, except for the infotainment system might. I will put that one caveat in there, that there's probably going to be a learning curve with their touchpad infotainment system, but everything else about the interior feels super welcoming, and it feels right. So more to come.
The infotainment I struggled with. You know, my driving habits have changed a little bit during the pandemic, going from like relatively short commuting to fewer like daily errands to more like, we got a press car like this, it's fun to take it out, stretch it out on the weekends, and you know, that sort of thing. You know, maybe other people are doing more driving, but for me, I never figured out and got comfortable with the infotainment. Some of that probably is that, like, the curve is just so steep that unless you really are getting in the car every day and using it, it's easy to forget if you go a couple days to me without using it. It's just like, I did not find it intuitive. I found it, you know, very dense, if you will, just to do basic tasks. And I, you know, I want to check myself because I'm not, frankly, the most tech savvy person. But then I also had the Mach-E in my driveway at actually the same time. And that car is an all touchpad, like, infotainment, like 15.5 inch screen. And literally, barely even looking at it, I paired my phone and I was just whipping through the radio stations and changing the settings of the car without even thinking, going from like engaging to, there's one that I hate to say, this is unbridled, a little cheesy, but there's a third one. I mean, that's how it's supposed to be. You know, initial impressions of the infotainment, not good. You know, it's just, it shouldn't be this hard. No matter how clever or smart it is, I don't know. We'll get somebody else in this car and we'll see what they think too, but you know, it did not resonate with me.
I'm super in the middle of the road on it right now. You know, it's I like the positioning and that it's out there, like towards the actual windshield. So you don't have to take your eyes that far off the road. You know, you don't have to really look down to see it or anything, which is a similar characteristic in Mazdas these days, in that the actual screen is just like a short glance away from the instrument cluster and the windshield, which I think, you know, really helps with you're trying to change a setting and you don't want to be distracted. But the actual functionality of it, like you say, can be a bit cumbersome. So we'll see as I hopefully get more and more acclimated to it over the days. I know that that's the way that Acura would like to pitch it, and that, you know, you own it, you get used to it, eventually you like it. That's why we do long-term tests. We'll see.
Absolutely. And again, it's also different users, different circumstances, you know. I'm sure there's some people that, you know, I'll be interested to see what John Snyder thinks of this too, because he, I know he picked up on some of the Subaru nuances in our long-term Forester that I didn't. You know, he's a busy guy, so I mean, maybe he'll, you know, be using the car a little bit more. I mean, my engagements, if you will, with the TLX were more like long, cathartic drives, you know, so sometimes I was even looking to mess with a radio, if you will. But it's also like, it is super frustrating when you can't toggle between like radio stations when you're just trying to queue up the Red Wings game, getting takeout, you know, like this is technology we figured out in the 50s with a button on the dashboard. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to get too hot on it just because, again, I didn't like it. Somebody else might, but it was a little bit of a pain. Now, it was more than a pain, and it was, yeah, not where I would land. So, but overall, I really like the car. It's good to talk to somebody about it too, because I think this car is, it's ambitious, it's attractive, it's very fun to drive. There's more to come with some of the different variants that we know are going to be coming even as soon as the spring. So how about we spend some money?
Let's do it. I like spending money.
All right. So this one comes from longtime listener James Ty, who lives near Toronto. Hey guys, I love the show. Wondering if anyone has any experience with garage lifts for extra parking space. Well, I think that's great because we have Zach Palmer on the show who has a lot of experience with lifts. So if not, still he wants to hear our hot takes. So yeah, I think you have more than a few experiences here. Let me read a few more details here, but then we can just get into it. I got a two-car garage with two cars now. This is where the lift comes in. You'd like to have a third weekend summer car. James lives near Toronto, fair amount of snow. I hear you there. Want to avoid leaving it outside. That makes a lot of sense. And obviously getting up early and scraping is no fun. So other options to consider, what lifts do you recommend? I think it also might be fun to talk about what third car James should get. So I think I got all of that out there. Mr. Lift, please tell me, what should James do?
Yeah, so my dad bought one of these things about 10-ish years ago at this point. It's a four-point lift, so it's one that you can actually store a car on, like the question is asking. You don't want a two-point lift to actually store a car on. That's a lot better for, you know, if you want to do suspension work, brake work, or any kind of work under the car. So he got one of these to do exactly this, to put the sports car up and then have a third garage spot underneath it to keep a car out of the snow and just store the sports car in a clean, dry, and warm-ish environment. And I think it is a genius solution, honestly. Right off the top, I would highly suggest that you get the lift. The pluses are huge. You know, in addition to actually being able to store your car up there, you also now have something that works great to do a number of different odd jobs on cars. I can't even count the number of oil changes that I've performed using this lift. You know, it makes it stupid easy. You don't have to jack a car up. You don't have to like crawl underneath it. You just put it on the lift, yank off the bolt, and off you go. It's like 5 or 10 minutes to do a whole oil change. It's fantastic. And then you can even do even more complex jobs. My dad and I, many years back, we swapped out the exhaust manifolds on his 1991 NSX for some freer-flowing headers on this lift. It gives you access to the whole underside of a car if you want to do work on it. And if you're going to have a third older/sports car, you could find yourself doing that, doing mods, general maintenance and whatnot. It's a really, really awesome, convenient thing to have. And, you know, you might find yourself wanting to do the job as opposed to taking it in somewhere and paying big money for it. And, you know, those are some really big benefits. There are, you know, some limitations when you do get the four-post lift. Like I said, you can't really do suspension or brake work. You know, you'll have to do that on the ground still, which is doable. I still do it that way. You know, there's no way around it. A few things to look out for. I think if you do end up getting a four post lift, spec the aluminum ramps. Now, we have steel ramps, and they're super, super heavy. You're constantly moving them around. It gets annoying. After a certain amount of time, you're just like, oh my God, I wish I had these aluminum ramps that weighed like 5 pounds each and lifted on and off, because you're constantly moving on and off and then throwing them up there, and they're huge, super unwieldy things. And then also, watch your head. I cannot even count the number of times that both my dad and I have rocked our skulls on our lift. You know, if you're doing work on it, the car, you know, isn't completely raised up, or if you're over, say, like 5'10", 5'9", you're going to be hard pressed to find a lift that will actually go up high enough to keep you from smashing your head on it. Especially if you're parking a car underneath it, and you park a car underneath it, and then you get up and out of the car, and you just smash your head on the actual lift itself. I've done that a few times. It's never fun. one other thing that I've seen in this whole time is watching the car that's up there to make sure it's not leaking fluids on the car that is below you, or the actual lift itself. My car has had oil dripped on it before. Unfortunately, the actual lift itself has had some oil leaks and dripped oil on the paint. Not fun stuff. It doesn't like to come off of paint if it's left there and you say you don't notice it. So, you know, with those, you know, cautions in mind, I think absolutely go for a 4-post lift. It makes life super great, super easy. And you can get a third car in a 2-car garage, or a fourth car in a 3-car garage. It's absolutely worth the investment if you're going to stay in whatever home that you're putting it in, because they're obviously not cheap and they don't move easily. You have to pay a lot of money to get them installed or removed. So those are my thoughts on the lift.
I have nothing to add to that. That was perfect. I don't have much experience with lifts. So I think, James, I hope that answers your question. I hope you do well in your search for, you know, a lift for your garage. You know, it's great. Great thing to have, it sounds like. What would be your third car that you would recommend there, Zach? He's not actually asking, but if you're just going to get a third car, we'll just say, like, I don't know, Miata-type money, what would you recommend?
Third weekend / summer car. Maybe buy a Miata. Yeah. Miata-type money. I mean, that'd be my first choice. You know, if you're looking for a fun summer car, basically, however much budget you have, you know, if you have, you know, budget for an ND, you know, that would be my choice, especially. But beyond that, maybe, you know, if you want something older, I know that I've been constantly searching around for first generation Boxsters. Those would be a fantastic addition as a summer car, and you'll probably find yourself working on it too, and utilizing your lift, especially because it's a mid-engine car, so you'll probably be needing to access things that are up underneath there, right in the center of the car. It's a big help in those situations. So those would be my two top picks, I suppose, for a cheap-ish summer car. Basically, however much Boxster or however much Miata you can afford.
Those are good ones. Those are reasonable ones. I would say, I was thinking used Cayman. I would say, yeah, you got to go with Miata just because, you know, why not? And I think an old Alfa Spider might be fun. I'm told Alfa Romeos often need a lot of work. So
they do.
You know, you might spend a little time or two wrenching on that. So, hey, we'll leave it there. V8s and lifts and a bunch of cars. This is a good show. Send us your Spend My Monies. That's podcast@autoblog.com. Be safe out there. We'll see you next week.